Welcome to S&C Critical Insights. I'm Annie Ostrager, a partner in S&C's litigation group, a member of the firm's Criminal Defense and Investigations group, and co-head of the Labor and Employment Law group. Today, we're going to talk about anti-fraternization policies, including what they are, why they're becoming increasingly important, and what firms need to consider when instituting such policies. With me today to discuss is Elizabeth Cassidy, special counsel in the firm's litigation group.
Hi, Annie.
Liz, let's start from the beginning. What are anti-fraternization policies?
A good place to start. Anti-fraternization policies are policies that govern relationships between employees at the workplace. They focus on, but are not limited to, romantic relationships, particularly between subordinates and supervisors. As we will discuss, there are different versions of anti-fraternization policies that can be enacted, which can vary in their level of stringency, follow-up requirements, and other key metrics. It's important to note that there's been increased focus on these policies in the wake of the @MeToo movement, which has caused companies to become more attuned to how they are managing these dynamics in the workplace and corresponding litigation risk.
That's right. In fact, a 2018 study found that more than half of companies reviewed have some kind of anti-fraternization policy in place. This reflects a steep increase over a relatively short period of time, with a 2013 survey reporting that in 2005, only around a quarter of U.S. employers had policies addressing consensual relationships. Liz, can you talk a little bit about the form these policies can take and the scope of what can be covered under them?
Sure. Anti-fraternization policies range from strict prohibitions on intra-office relationships to merely requiring reporting when such relationships do arise. There can be a blanket ban on relationships among employees or a prohibition only when there is a direct or indirect reporting between the employees. A company should also consider how relationships need to be disclosed and to whom.
Right. These policies need to be calibrated to the type of workplace that they're going to be applied to. And it's important because companies need to ensure protections are in place to guard against allegations of retaliation from reporting if senior personnel are involved.
That's right. And it's also crucial to define reporting lines when relationships are prohibited between a superior and subordinates, particularly between employees in especially sensitive positions or areas such as audit.
Yes, companies should also make clear what the consequences of relationships and their disclosure will be and think through issues such as, will one employee be reassigned? What will be the method for deciding who will be the reassigned or transferred employee? How will that method safeguard against the possibility of the more junior person necessarily being the one facing employment ramifications? How will culpability be taken into account? And how will that be determined? In addition, how does the company's business and ownership structure impact potential responses?
Yes, it's important that there be transparency and training. This goes hand in hand with company culture generally. In that respect, company leaders play an important role in setting a tone from the top. It's clear that anti-fraternization policies can be very high stakes and that the role of leadership in setting tone also carries heightened responsibility to abide by the company policy. For example, Intel announced in June 2018 that its CEO was stepping down after confirming he violated a non-fraternization policy that had been in place since 2011, revealing that he and a champion of its corporate diversity initiatives had a past consensual relationship with an Intel employee.
Agreed. And that's not the only high-profile example of an issue implicating these kinds of policies. The CEO of McDonald's stepped down after similarly engaging in a consensual relationship in violation of an anti-fraternization policy.
The violation of anti-fraternization policies, including due to inadequate training on or dissemination of relevant policies, can not only have a significant impact on productivity, but as we mentioned, can also expose a company and its executives to legal risk.
In light of all this, what are some pros and cons of instituting such a policy?
So the pros, which are likely more apparent, include sending a message against sexual harassment, mitigating legal risk, and avoiding certain toxic work environment situations. In addition, anti-fraternization policies provide employees with notice regarding potential consequences of a workplace relationship and they also afford employers a bright line rule. On the flip side, cons may include the creation of a perception of paternalism and the need for difficult line drawing. Of course, it is difficult to police workplace relationships and to discern from afar which relationships fall under the policy. The proper implementation of anti-fraternization policies requires hard choices about who qualifies as a supervisor, how employees are reassigned, and potential intrusion into employees' personal lives.
Agreed, Liz. Those are all important subjects to think about as a company designs a version of an anti-fraternization policy that best fits its business. There are additional issues that may bear on anti-fraternization policies. For example, at least one very expansive version of such a policy prohibited fraternizing on duty or off duty, dating or becoming overly friendly with the client's employees or with co-employees. And this was held to violate the National Labor Relations Act because the court found that the policy was so broad as to prohibit employees from discussing the terms and conditions of their employment. There may also be salient differences in state law that a company needs to consider in enacting such a policy. Many states have labor legislation protecting the privacy rights of employees to engage in legal activities during non-work hours and off of work premises. California, for example, permits an employer to fire a supervisor for having a relationship with a subordinate and has held that supervisors have no privacy right to engage in intimate relationships with their subordinates. In general, however, prohibitions on supervisor-supervisee relationships can be justified by the unique employer interest implicated. Companies, especially those that do business in multiple jurisdictions, need to be cautious when implementing anti-fraternization policies to ensure that they understand the legal landscape in all relevant jurisdictions.
That's right, Annie. And in addition, a company should consider the potential impact of anti-fraternization policies on other office regulations and policies. For example, those regarding corporate finances, interactions with clients, and quality of work. To that end, the company should think carefully about the codification of the internal investigation process employed in the context of anti-fraternization policies and the extent to which the policies impact the type of investigation that is conducted. A company should ask, for example, what portion of the investigation will be entirely in-house and when, if ever, will external resources be brought in?
It's a good point, Liz, and I agree. This brings us to how these policies interact with issues companies have been grappling with since the inception of the Me Too movement that you touched on a few minutes ago. And companies need to be attuned to ensuring that these policies are implemented in a gender-neutral manner that does not cause any adverse ramifications for protected groups of employees. For example, a recent case in Alabama held that a former employee could proceed to trial on her sex discrimination claim after she was not selected for a promotion and was later discharged for violation of the company's anti-fraternization policy, while her partner, who later became her husband, was not.
Yes, and the Supreme Court has ruled that an employer is subject to vicarious liability to a victimized employee for an actionable hostile environment created by a supervisor with immediate or successively higher authority over the employee. There is strict liability in such circumstances where the victim suffered a tangible employment action, such as dismissal or demotion. If, on the other hand, the offending conduct is committed by an employee who is not in a managerial or supervisory role, the employer is strictly liable for sexual harassment if the employer became aware of the conduct and subsequently failed to take reasonable corrective measures.
Yes, important points, Liz. And as you touched on earlier, anti-fraternization policies should work in tandem with company trainings, including training that is specific to employees in supervisory roles. Employees should have clear information on whom to contact if they wish to report unwanted sexual or romantic advances, including, if possible, an anonymous option for reporting, and how to report consensual relationships in the workplace, if that's permitted under company policy.
To wrap up, Annie, what are some key takeaways?
I think we've touched on a number of these, but this is an important area that companies should be thinking about, every company needs to consider carefully whether an anti-fraternization policy makes sense for their workplace, and if so, what its scope will be and how it will be implemented. Thank you for listening, and for more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.fulcrum.com.